Well, let me begin by bringing you greetings from our brothers and sisters in Jos in Nigeria, where, as many of you will know, I've been for 8 days. Thank you so much for praying for me and for that trip. It was a kind of encouraging, disturbing, challenging, well worthwhile time. I'll say more about it at the praise and prayer time on Tuesday evening. They are absurdly grateful for visits from places like here, their thankfulness to England, because they know their history. And they know that we sent the gospel to them. And they're hugely encouraged to know there are still Bible, gospel-believing churches around, and they insisted again and again that I pass their greetings to you. And the Archbishop Ben Quashy, his wife Gloria Benz, preached here for us. They personally again send their greetings to you all. One of the highlights of the trip for me, one of the things I was looking forward to, was visiting a school which Ben and especially his wife Gloria have really set up and run, that I looked in at the first time I went there a few years back. It was kind of lunchtime then, and I just sort of helped with serving lunch and so on. This time I was on the last day of term. Last term you could do anything, and I was given the full treatment. So as the school was gathered together, they did a little dance for me. And I was hugely thankful they didn't ask me to dance with them. That would have been disastrous. They danced for me, they were thankful. Two of them prayed for me. It was one of the most moving things on the trip, and it wasn't just a kind of God bless you type prayer. Here's this sort of 10, 11-year-old praying for 2 or 3 minutes with huge insight, really, about someone she'd never met before from a country she knew little or nothing about, and yet praying for God's blessing on ministry for my own Christian walk and life. It was wonderful. When we arrived at the school, and there were 2 or 3 of us there, as we got out of the car and headed towards the school, some of the kids were playing around in the sort of play area. One little kid, I mean, he looked as if he couldn't have been more than 4, came rushing up, and clearly he'd just been starting to learn his English alphabet. And he wanted to try it out on us. A, B, D, he went. C, we said. D, he said. No, C, C, A, B, D. Well, you know, we kind of worked it on. 70 to 80% of the children in that school are orphans. Nearly all the rest from severely dysfunctional families, any background, Christian, Muslim, whatever. Many of them are now part of the Quashy family. Ben and Gloria have legally adopted them. Sometimes there's been no relative to sign the papers, so it's the village chief who has to authorize it. But now they are legally and in every other way their family. And I'm visiting the Archbishop the next evening. And again, as we pull up at the house and get out, Stephen comes rushing out and starts again. A, B, D, C. Well, once in the 5 minutes we're with him, I think he gets from A to G in the right sequence, but then it gets lost again. And at family prayers, I'm there with them as Ben leads family prayers. I count up to 43 children in the room that were there that evening. And over dinner, we're talking about them and the others at the school and the place of education in this holistic mission, for that's what's going on. And Ben says, look, in Nigeria, we have no cushions like you have. He means we don't have a benefit system. We don't have a welfare state like we can enjoy. So he says, education is the best hope. Education is the only hope for providing for them. Talks about how he's given up all his dreams of retirement as Gloria keeps on fishing out more children to join the family. He says, look, education is what can give them a qualification that can get them a job that can mean there's a chance of providing for them. Stephen, it turns out, is not 4. He's actually 9 years old. You'd never guess it looking at him. Like so many of the other children, he is HIV positive. As his health stabilizes, no one knows what the future holds and what he will be capable of. For some, that school has got them into mainstream state secondary school education. You can't see it happening for Stephen, but who knows? And he's obviously hungry to learn. And I think there, but But not just in Nigeria. You see, there is a hunger for education around. Malala Yousafzai, the young Pakistani girl who stood up for education and was shot by the Taliban, you know, has come to huge provenance. She said this: education is education. It's neither Eastern nor Western. It's the right of every human being. Well, it was recognized as such way back in 1966 by a United Nations convention, and yet today 57 million children are without access to education. When Malala talks about education, she's not thinking narrowly as if it's reduced to alphabets and times tables and academia. She spoke once of how her father has a framed copy hanging on his wall of a letter that Abraham Lincoln wrote to his son's teacher, translated into Pashto for them. "Teach him, if you can, the wonder of books," Lincoln wrote. "But also give him quiet time to ponder the eternal mystery of birds in the sky." You think John Stott would approve, don't you? And then he went on, "Teach him it is far more honorable to fail than to cheat." Now there's education for you, isn't it? Well, again, Malala speaks of this hunger and passion she has. In some parts of the world, she says, students are going to school every day. It's their normal life. But in other parts of the world, we're starving for education. It's like a precious gift. It's like a diamond. Well, Proverbs knows that language. That hunger, that starving for education. Look at verse 7 of chapter 4. "The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. Though it cost all you have, get understanding." Get wisdom. We all actually believe in education, don't we? I mean, literally the word comes from the Latin a, out, ducio, I lead. You know, to lead out, to bring up, and so to train. We want our children led out well. Brought up well. Education's a good thing. The Bible says so. Get wisdom. And all round the world where the gospel has been preached, education has followed. In the UK and abroad, the church has brought education to the people. That's why just down the road, there is the All Souls Primary School. Because just over 100 years ago, the church family here, wanting to serve this community, served it by providing an education for children. Of course, though, what we so often think of as education today has drifted from the wisdom we read of in Proverbs here. And we mustn't be naive. We need to spot the change in education. The writer of Proverbs, for example, isn't thinking of school as we think of it. You know, that kind of formal education didn't begin in Israel before New Testament times. The wisdom you were to get that was worth having at any cost was passed down in the home. The wisdom teacher is spoken of as a father speaking to a son because parents were the main teachers. "Listen, my son," the writer writes in his first chapter, "to your father's instruction and don't forsake your mother's teaching." They're both involved. So you remember back in Exodus chapter 12, as the Passover meal is set up on that dangerous life or death day and night back in Egypt. Instructions were also given for how this was a ceremony to be held annually, a yearly reminder. And as the instructions were put out, it was said this: when your children ask you, "What does this ceremony mean to you?" You don't say, "Ask in Sunday school." Now, then tell them, parents. Your responsibility. Deuteronomy 6 picks up God's commands and instructs, impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. There's not a formal lesson really there, is it? It's more threaded into the experience of everyday life. You see a theft and someone having to go without as a result, and you say, "That's why God says, do not steal." You watch a child looking after an aging parent, and you say, "Yeah, that's what it looks like to honor your mother and father." But it's not just majority world countries. Western education, too, can no longer trust the family. Too many broken or dysfunctional families where responsibilities have been abdicated. So school are not just expected to teach maths and English and history and so on and so forth, but hygiene and sex and religion too. Now, I spent nearly all my education in boarding school. My parents, I'm sure, did it from the best of motives. They wanted to give me what they saw as the best education they could. We quickly decided we weren't going to educate our children that way. It was easy to make it a great decision of principle because there was no way we were going to be able to afford to anyway, so it wasn't an option. But one likes to sort of get on a moral high ground at some point and think about it, you know. And we didn't need to. We weren't kind of living abroad or changing home every 2 or 3 years. But above all, we actually wanted to take the responsibility of parents ourselves. We didn't want to delegate this here. Especially, as most importantly in terms of difference, the wisdom of Proverbs is designed to bring us into relationship with God. Unlike so much of Western secular education. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, the writer says. That's the foundation of wisdom, a right relationship with the living God. At all costs, I'm to get that wisdom. Well, schools in secular societies like ours will never see that as the aim of education. It needn't stop the teacher, whatever the restraints and restrictions on content, from showing an attitude to teaching and children and life in general that reflects some of Proverbs' values. It needn't stop the student from using his or her education to help explore God's world, to see it, as one girl put it, as part of my loving God with all my mind. Or as someone else said rather shrewdly, I thought, the question I ask myself is, what do I learn about God in the lab? But education, modern Western education included, is a good thing, but we need to know its limits. Unlike the wisdom of Proverbs, for example, it will not bring us to God. Unlike the wisdom of Proverbs, it's a wisdom that does not save. Now, the Bible knows that kind of education and that kind of wisdom. Keep a finger in Proverbs 4 because we're coming back, but just turn on, would you, to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It's page 1144. Page 1144, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And watch as Paul talks of some different kinds of wisdom. One, a wisdom from God. One, a wisdom that doesn't save. Let me pick it up at verse 18. Chapter 1, verse 18. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it's written, I'll destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where's the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. See, he says there is a human wisdom that cannot explain the cross. God's greatest event in history and its foolishness to that wisdom. There is a human wisdom that cannot save, God's greatest gift for history, and it's missed by that wisdom. There is a human wisdom that does not leave us humble to learn and receive, but proud and standing on our own 2 feet and resting on our achievement. There is a wisdom of the world that cannot bring me to God. You saw what verse 21 said? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him. God wisely does not make access to him available to those with the IQ and the research abilities to discover. He is far more inclusive than that. Knowing him isn't done through science. Can't be pulled off by philosophy. It takes a different wisdom altogether. So to put our trust in an education that has the weaknesses of that human wisdom of the world is to head towards idolatry. It's a far cry from where we started. Come back to where you left your finger and Proverbs 4 and look again at verse 7. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. Get the wisdom that knows God. Get the wisdom that fears the Lord. Get the wisdom that enjoys His rescue. Get the wisdom that brings His life. Not an education that misses all those. So, with that in the background, let's just look a little more closely at what I've called the idolatry of education. Now, again, don't misunderstand me. Education, like our other idols we've looked at in this series, is a good thing in itself. Even the world's wisdom. Moses was educated in Pharaoh's court. Solomon knew zoology, Nehemiah logistics, Paul Greek poets. However they got their education, they used it in their life and ministry. But good things can become idols when they take the place that belongs rightly to God Himself. An education becomes an idol, for example, when it wrongly shapes our identity, when my qualifications define me more than my relationships to God. When I look at my GCSEs, A-levels, degrees, masters, PhDs, and think, that's me. Or you look at your children's results and think, that's them. And it's the first thing you think to write when you put together the Christmas letter, as if their results are more important than their walking with the Lord. When I'm recognized by my accomplishments and defined by my exam passes and not by being in Christ, then my education is in the wrong place. Sometimes parents do it to us, sometimes we do it to ourselves. I was talking with a friend this week and she said, I realized it was the one thing I could do at school. Couldn't cut it with the sporty types, wasn't in with the playground crowd, but I could do academics. My parents didn't push me, I did it to myself, and it took a lot of undoing. There's a great story told about Chris Evert, the tennis player. Those of us of a certain age will remember when she was number one. And she'd just been in another quarterfinal where she'd simply wiped the floor with one of those opponents for whom the quarterfinal is about as far as they ever get. And they were in the locker room afterwards. And the beaten one announced in a loud, meant-to-be-overheard voice, "Thank God my happiness doesn't depend on winning a tennis match." And Evert responded equally loudly, "Thank God mine does." Well, education becomes an idol when our results define us and give us our worth and our value. It's not intended to do that. Education becomes an idol when our schooling defines us. There's a very English question which runs like this: you know, what school did you go to? Yeah, you've got to, it sounds terribly innocent, but those in the know that if your answer, particularly if it's going to be an English school, as soon as I know your answer, I know exactly which box to put you in. And that probably has far more to do with social standing than anything to do with academics. It's actually a terrible way in any society to divide people. It's appalling when it happens in a Christian community. It's not exclusive to the English. We probably just do it more subtly than others do, because that's our way. Oh, when I was out in Nigeria, I was struck by a couple of people who came and talked to me about how a certain group and class in Nigeria very often send their children to the UK or the US for secondary schooling. Could be all kinds of good reasons for doing that. That wasn't really what got to them. What got under their skin was those parents speaking very often and very grandly about how we're just going to visit the children as a way of flaunting their importance and dividing. How we treat our children is often a reflection of what matters to us and how we'd like to think of ourselves, which makes August a terrible month in the UK as we wait for A-level and GCSE results to be published. Here's a question for parents. How can we help and encourage our children to wake up each morning and know that they're loved by God, to marvel at that, to be amazed by grace, not by passing exams? I suspect we can only begin if they've experienced that love from their parents. See, does the atmosphere and the talk at home tell them you can't love them more, whatever their success, and you won't love them less, whatever their failures? Is that what people would pick up in your home? It's not the same as saying exams don't matter. No. It just says there is a love that goes deeper. And education is not our God. It becomes an idol when it shapes identity. It becomes an idol when it takes priority over the things of God. When schoolwork takes priority over church, it means we neglect to meet together with one another. We miss out on being encouraged and spurred on, stirred up to love and to good works. How often did that happen last term, exam term? What did that say to your family? When the taught answer takes priority over the Christian conviction and truth, it's becoming an idol. For example, when evolution is inflated from being a generally accepted scientific theory into a total explanation of our humanity to the exclusion of God, and the student then repeats it. But it's so hard, isn't it, for a teenager not to write down what teacher has told them is the fact. I avoided that battle by not getting converted till I was an undergraduate student. But it came up when I was studying theology. So many of the professors, full of liberal teaching, discrediting the Bible, you could either repeat that in the essay, or you had to write a longer one engaging with the radical theories and still attempting to show the Bible account is credible. Brenda Beckett, our children's worker, she sees each C-zone child in year six in their last year of primary school, just before they head up this September to secondary school and to the youth work here. And she talks with each one of them individually. They've been looking at Hebrews, so she talked to them about Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1. We must pay the most careful attention, therefore, to what we've heard so that we do not drift away. And the question she asked each child was this: as you go up to secondary school, what do you think might make you drift away from Jesus? She told me the other day, every child but two in their answer included school work. Not school friends, school work. Parents, you have been warned. That's what your children are saying. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. Though it cost all you have, get understanding. It can feel as if it's going to cost all you have, can't it, to some UK parents, as if education's a ladder that's got to be climbed from the start of primary school. You know, your child needs to have made this progress by key stage one if they're going to be where they need to be at key stage two, so they'll be far enough ahead for their GCSEs. And the poor child is still only four. Asian families who know more clearly, who prize more deeply the value of education, they can take it almost literally, though it cost you all you have. One Asian friend said to me that when he realized the sacrifices his parents had made to get him to university, he felt all the guilt and obligation on his shoulders as he sought to perform at university. But this wisdom that Proverbs speaks of, this worth getting at any cost wisdom, is not identical to his education, to today's schooling. You read the early chapters of Proverbs and it'll tell you this wisdom is a tree of life. And you know what that picture stands for in the Bible. This wisdom is a lamp and a light like the Word of God itself. This wisdom leads me to God, not away from Him. This wisdom leads me to the Jesus who says, "Learn of me." This is the wisdom that needs the highest priority in my living and my learning. Give that priority to another education, or will you start to make it an idol? And actually, long after school and student days are past and exam successes and failures are a faded memory, we're still to be learners. Proverbs speaks to us and says, get wisdom. This wisdom. Well, this time last week I was just finishing. I was preaching in a church. We had a 3-hour plus communion service, but the vicar said in the notices these used to last 5 hours, so this is the abbreviated version. And after that, I just went to say goodbye to Ben and Gloria Quashie before heading to Abuja to catch my plane. Went to the Archbishop's home, and as I got there and got out of the car and headed to the home, there's Stephen running up again. A, B, D, C, A, B. At the end of the time there, we did a sort of high fives together. Well, it was a low five because he's not very tall. And we did that. I said, Stephen, next time I see you, I'd love to hear the whole alphabet. Well, who knows whether Stephen will manage that. But I know the education he's getting at school. I know the family he's a child of. Whether he can tell me the whole alphabet next time, I don't know. But I do know this, so far as humanly possible, he will know he's loved by God. So far as humanly possible, he will have been brought to the Jesus who says, learn of me. So far as it's humanly possible for him, he will have got wisdom. This wisdom. The wisdom that could take our last hymn and sing it with the confidence it owns. In Christ alone, my hope is found.